From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Trump administration said today that it will end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, which has shielded about 800,000 immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally as children from deportation. President Obama created DACA through executive action in 2012. Earlier today, Attorney General Jeff Sessions said the Trump administration is taking those protections away from so-called Dreamers.
This does not mean they are bad people or that our nation disrespects or demeans them in any way. It means we are properly enforcing our laws as Congress has passed them. It is with these principles and duties in mind, and in light of imminent litigation, that we reviewed the Obama administration's DACA policy.
Joining us now by Skype is Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. He's in Miami. Hi, Alan.
How you doing, Jeremy?
Doing well. And we knew this announcement was coming about DACA, but were there any surprises there for you in today's announcement?
I mean, we've known this was coming for weeks, if not months, that something was going to happen. The big question was always whether President Trump was going to just shut it off entirely and all the DACA protections would be eliminated immediately, or whether he would allow this kind of phase out. And so that's what we got, this slow, gradual. It won't be until March 6th is theoretically the first time a DACA recipient could lose their status completely, and then they'll slowly be phased out over the next 2.5 years.
And what does that mean for DACA recipients? If they're hearing this today, what's their future?
Well, yeah, it sounds, nice, orderly phase out, is I think how Attorney General Sessions put it at one point today. But for the nearly 800,000 people who have this, I can tell you there's nothing orderly or calm about this. All of them are basically on the clock right now, and all of them have to start making decisions almost immediately about what they're going to do with their jobs, with whether they're in universities. A lot of them, think about this. Every employer now has to make a decision. Okay, I have this DACA employee that's working for me. Can I keep them past that date? They will become an undocumented immigrant, and federal government will know very well what their status is because they have all their information. So they have to start making decisions about their jobs. The ones who are going to school, while most states in the country allow for undocumented immigrants of all kinds to attend any state university, there are tons of scholarships, work opportunities for them at these universities that's helping them pay for it. A lot of them have side jobs. So when you bring all that together, there's just so many things that they're going to have to decide in the very near future, even if their term doesn't expire for a year or two.
And President Trump has pushed Congress to act on this issue. Is it likely that there's support in Congress for doing something about DACA? Because they haven't been ready to do that in the past.
They haven't been able to do that for 16 years,
right,
which is when DACA was, when the Dream Act was first introduced in Congress. And, it was just a few years ago that they got really close. Back in 2010, the House passed a version of the Dream Act, and it fell just a few votes shy in the Senate. But if it's been 16 years and they haven't been able to get it together, I just find it very hard to believe that this Congress, in this political environment, is going to be able to come up with what Sessions refers to as amnesty, and what a lot of the hardcore Republicans and immigration hardliners in Congress believe to be amnesty. They're going to be hearing a lot about these dreamers as they lose their protections. There's going to be a lot of advocacy. They're going to be hearing, there's going to be a lot of marches, a lot of protests, a lot of rallies. A couple of hunger strikes have already started today, so it'll be incredibly visible, and there'll be a lot of pressure on them. But there's been a lot of pressure on them in the past to pass the Dream Act. So I just don't see any calculus where all of a sudden now things are going to, line up and they're suddenly going to pass something.
So what happens to Dreamers, given what you were saying earlier about their job status and their university status or whatever they might be doing? Do you expect a lot of them to just now go into hiding, or what do you think?
That's what they're going to have to do. We were on a call this morning with Department of Homeland Security officials who made very clear that they have priorities and they have people that they're focusing their immigration efforts on. Those are, people who've committed felonies, who pose a threat to national security, the big ones like that. But as we've seen from this administration, every single month that the president has been in office, the percentage of undocumented immigrants arrested without a criminal record has increased each month. And so all that to say that all these DACA recipients see that and are aware that just because they had DACA at some point, is not going to give them any sort of pass in the eyes of an ICE agent that they encounter on the street. So, yeah, for them, they basically have to go back to life as it was before, living in the shadows, trying to find work when you don't have work authorization, and just trying to avoid when you see an ICE agent coming through your neighborhood.
That's Alan Gomez, who is immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
To North Korea now, which, according to South Korea's Asia Business Daily, moved an intercontinental ballistic missile under cover of darkness last night, perhaps preparing for another missile test. Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin called North Korea's huge underground bomb test on Sunday provocative, but he also said further sanctions against North Korea would be useless. They'd rather eat grass than give up their nuclear program. Of course, his own country is under sanctions for the seizure of Crimea. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley's call for tougher sanctions came after Sunday's test, which raised fears that North Korea is ready to weaponize a missile. So lots going on. Let's bring in Jonathan Marcus, the BBC's defense and diplomatic correspondent in London. Jonathan, Putin called for talks, but you write talks about what? North Korea, like Pakistan, will not give up its nuclear program. The U.S. will not pull troops out of South Korea, probably not drop sanctions. So what do you think talks could be about?
It's a very good question. I mean, clearly up until now, the emphasis on talks, the guiding principle behind talks was that whatever the outcome, one part of it would be North Korea freezing and then rolling back its nuclear program. Now, clearly, North Korea's nuclear and missile capability is now so much greater, it seems very unreasonable to think that it will simply give this up. But I think if North Korea simply by talks wants to see the international, as it were, approval of its status as a nuclear weapons state, then I think clearly there isn't going to be much room for maneuver.
Talk about Kim Jong-un's fears in North Korea, thinking about something that maybe U.S. officials aren't even thinking about. He's apparently thinking a lot about Muammar Gaddafi in Libya and how Gaddafi gave up part of his nuclear program and still was taken down with the help of the U.S.
Well, look, a lot of people try and argue that the North Koreans are irrational. But I think there is a logic behind North Korea's actions. It has rightly, as you said, looked at Iraq particularly and Libya and taken the view that if you're a country that is at odds with the United States, that having nuclear weapons is something that will guarantee your continuation in power, guarantee the safety of your regime. If you give up those weapons, then the Americans are likely, with others, to simply sweep you away. So that is not illogical or irrational. What is peculiar is exactly the way the North Korean regime is going about behaving at the moment, behaving in ways that are almost a kind of Russian roulette, you know, dare us to do something. And of course, the fear is that something will happen with a, let's be honest, certainly viewed from Europe, an American administration that is less nimble diplomatically on its feet. And that could exaggerate the possibility of miscalculation, misunderstanding, and something that the North Koreans do triggering some kind of catastrophic conflict.
Look, what do you see as end game here, given that some fear that the end game is that Kim Jong-un does weaponize one of these missiles that can reach an American city, and there's absolutely nothing the U.S. can do?
It may be that the West has to accept that North Korea is, you know, a significant nuclear player. The problem, of course, is to contain it. And we're already beginning to see that with President Trump agreeing now to sell more advanced weaponry to South Korea and to Japan. The Americans and the South Koreans, America lifting some of the restrictions on the range and payload of South Korea's own indigenous missile programs and so on. And even one South Korean minister, the South Korean defense minister, raising the question, at least as something that might be talked about, as the reintroduction of U.S. tactical nuclear weapons into South Korea, although I think that probably isn't the view of the South Korean president himself. So you can see the sort of direction in which things are going.
Well, the militarization. And is there any possibility, I mean, it's sort of a kumbaya thought when we're dealing with someone like a Kim Jong-un, but is there any possibility that through talks and through diplomacy and through the help of China and Russia, China doesn't want to see North Korea fall. They don't want a unified Korean peninsula because that would be run by South Korea. Is there any possibility of dropping some of the sanctions and actually helping North Korea?
The problem is nobody wants to relax the pressure on North Korea until there is some clear sign that North Korea is ready to come to the table. But then, as I say, you have the fundamental question as to what precisely it is they are going to talk about.
The BBC's defense and diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus, in London. Jonathan, thank you.
Pleasure.
And we've been following the Trump administration's decision today to rescind the Obama executive orders known as DACA, young people brought as children to the U.S. before 2007 by their undocumented parents, given work permits and deferment from deportation if they meet certain qualifications. Unless Congress creates a new law, it's the end of DACA. So what are the political questions?
Let's get to our political analyst, Paris Denard, a Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello.
And Angela Rye, a Democratic strategist. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Angela, I want to start with you. As a Democratic strategist, as you look at what was just announced today, what do you think?
I think it's heartless. I think that so often what we've seen from Donald Trump with his campaign, as well as with what the announcement was today, not by Donald Trump, by the way, MIA completely, as that announcement was made by
Jeff
Sessions.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions, right.
That's right. What I think is interesting is that we continue to implement policy and or rescind policy without taking into consideration the lives that are at stake. We're talking about 800,000 people who came here as children. We're talking about people, many of which never have known another home except for America. We're talking about people who sit in your classrooms, who may be arguing their dissertation at the same time as you, who may be hospital workers or working on the next app you're going to download. These are human beings who are contributing every day to the American economy. And now they're saying, for example, Forward.us and the Center for American Progress put out data that says that upwards of 30,000 DACA recipients per month will be losing their jobs as a result of this repeal.
Look, Paris, I'm going to bring you in here. This is something that President Trump supporters really wanted. But this is a finite group of highly educated people. They had to be under 30 here before 2007, go to school or the military, not have a criminal record. The Cato Institute estimates that the fiscal cost of deporting them will be over $60 billion, and there will be a $280 billion reduction in economic growth. Why do this when it's a finite group of people?
Well, I think there's just a few points. One, the government said that the actual number is 690, and so the notion that it's 800 plus is inaccurate. And number two is that
that's not inaccurate. There's data.
Well,
six. The DACA does not lead to mass deportation. I think that that's another falsehood about this. What President Trump and the administration did today. What we have to keep in mind is that this was always meant to be a temporary measure. President Obama said that himself. This is something that is a byproduct of the Congress failing to act during the Obama administration, especially when he had a 60-vote Democrat majority in the Senate, and President Obama doing something outside of congressional authority, which is the body that's supposed to enact these laws. And so the fact that this is being rescinded is an important thing, but we have to keep in mind that it is not immediate. This immediate rescission of DACA was likely because of the way this was going out by the attorney generals following the lawsuit, which had to be decided upon today, and the court and the judge that this was going to be before had done so under VRDAPA immediately. And so the president said, let's deal with this, give a six-month runway, which I think is responsible, which I think is respectful, and then let the Congress do the right thing, which is what the Congress is supposed to do.
But
the president is acting respectfully
and
responsibly.
We have already been speaking with somebody who knows this issue very well today, immigration reporter at USA Today, Alan Gomez, who says it's not really all that likely that Congress is going to step in and do
They're
something
not.
About this.
Well, then that falls at the face of the Congress. Once again, the Congress is going to have to get a spine and do what they're supposed to do by the people who elected them to do this. The administration, the president is not the king. The president cannot just make edicts and create laws with that Congress, the separation of powers, are supposed to do. So Congress is going to have to act.
Jump in,
Robin.
Angela,
can I just
jump in? Yeah.
So really quick, I hope that you all will play that line back again later when this is not an argument that Paris is siding with it. The president is not the king and he can't issue edicts. But on a more serious note, I think it's really important for us to understand that this has been a challenge under both Democratic administrations and Republican administrations. Parrish, you referenced Barack Obama's administration and the attempt that they made to enforce and or enact some type of comprehensive immigration legislation. But you forgot in 2001, when I think you were working for George W. Bush, when they ran into the same problems. So I think we should be, yes, Congress should have a spine. Congress should act. But in the meantime, why would you put at stake more than 800,000 young people and their families? Why would you put at stake our nation's security, our nation's economy, to prove a point and to score cheap political points on the backs of these young people that did not come here necessarily on their own?
Well, the thing that I should point out is that while the Congress failed to enact comprehensive immigration reform under the Bush administration, the difference between President Bush and President Obama is President Bush did not decide to do something like this DACA program, which he knew would not pass muster through Congress. And
well,
many people
God
say
Barack
it's unconstitutional. And so this is an
it's
issue
not.
That we have to deal with, that Congress needs to deal with. And it is something that they're not children. They're adults. The average age is 22.
They came here
it ranges
when they
up to 35.
Listen.
They came
both,
here when they were children.
You're both talking
Harris.
About
that's a fact.
And yes, and brought without
illegally.
Any knowledge.
Let's just talk about the fact that they're illegal. That we
they're
we
not
are
illegal.
Of laws.
We're not going to call human
we
beings
are,
illegal, Paris. That's not
are,
that's not okay. So
they,
are you illegal are, when you jaywalk? Are you illegal when you jaywalk? Don't call a human
being
illegal.
Yeah, if I break
illegal.
The law, I am illegal. And if the police
no,
sees me, he should.
Come on,
yeah, that's an illegal act.
That's a civil infraction.
Look, Paris,
it's
I'm
a civil infraction.
Just want to jump in here and ask Paris. You as Jeff Sessions has said. Are arguing that this isn't something that a president can do, but this is a president who's tried a ban on Muslims. So it's obviously, you know, something that his office has tried to do. But I want to ask you about the politics here. What do you think is going to happen in Congress? You have Arizona Senator John McCain calling this the wrong approach to immigration policy. Jeff Flake said the same thing last week. What's going to happen
Paul
in the
Ryan,
Republican
the House Speaker?
Yeah. Hey, what's going to happen within the Republican Party?
Listen, I get that this is not politically expedient for the people in Congress. I know they don't want to tackle the tough issues. They want to pass the buck and keep passing down the line. They don't want to do the tough things, but they're going to have to do it. And the American people, the people who voted them into office, the people who voted President Trump into office, who support this America First agenda, are going to require of them to do their job and to act and stop kicking these things down the road and not dealing with it. This is the problem with infrastructure. This is the problem with our tax system. This is the problem with Social Security. This is the problem with the issue with the nuclear deal. All of these things are because of failures of Congress to act when they should.
So just really quick, I just want to respond to this. I think it's kind of irresponsible of us also to act as if Congress has not acted. We know that on a bipartisan level, Senators Dick Durbin and Lindsey Graham also introduced the DREAM Act. This would actually solve this very issue that we're talking about. So it would be nice for the president not to pass the buck onto Congress and to ensure that they have the support they need. You're actually asking them to champion and push of an issue like this going into the midterm elections. I would love to see Republicans do the right thing, Paris, but I don't know that folks on your side of the aisle know what that is. You have a bigot like Steve King who regularly tweets things attacking folks who are immigrants here. And then you have folks like Lindsey Graham and John McCain who are on the complete other side of this issue. You also have your president who championed the bigotry associated with immigration. Robin just brought up the Muslim ban issue, so he's tried to address immigration policy through executive order, and it's been challenged and clearly unconstitutional when it really did go beyond the scope. So I think we have to be very honest about where we are and what the problems actually are and how to solve for them. It is clear that there's been a bill introduced here.
I want to step in because in the 2 minutes that we have left, we do need to talk about just a couple of other things that are going on in Washington besides DACA. This is going to be a huge month in Congress with deadlines to raise the debt limit and pass a temporary spending bill that may or may not include funding for President Trump's wall. And then passing aid for Harvey victims was added onto that list. On Fox News Sunday, the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, said he wants to attach Harvey aid money for Texas to a bill to raise the debt limit, even though some House conservatives oppose that idea. Let's listen.
The president and I believe that it should be tied to the Harvey funding, that our first priority is to make sure that the state gets money. It is critical. And to do that, we need to make sure we raise the debt limit.
Paris, is that likely to happen? And are we facing the possibility at this point of a government shutdown or a default on the debt?
I think that the president is telling the American people through our Treasury Secretary that the aid to Harvey is something that needs to be done. Under normal circumstances, they would not attach it to it. But because of the crisis is so severe, the money that is so much needed, this is something that needs to be done to get the Congress to come together and act, because these are two pressing things that have to be done at a moment's notice. The debt ceiling is a pertinent issue, as well as Harvey funding. Put it together, get it done.
And you know, once again, we've had an entire segment where we just don't discuss the Democrats. Angela, what is your party not doing that it should and can be doing now?
I think that, I would agree with Paris that this is something that needs to be done. I want to just be clear that it's not going to happen in the House. The House Freedom Caucus and others are not going to go for a debt ceiling bill being tied to Harvey funding. I think Democrats have been very clear about what they should be supporting and how. I think you're going to see them out on the streets today of fighting against this DACA repeal. And I think they need to continue going forward, pushing against an agenda that is bigoted and discriminatory.
Well, we didn't get to the meeting today with the president and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Love to be a fly on that wall because the president wants to talk about tax reform, but he's been blasting McConnell for failing to pass Obamacare. So a lot of bruised feelings here. Paris Denard, our Republican strategist, Angela Rye, the Democratic strategist, will keep asking you about it. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
The toy maker Lego said today that it is cutting 1,400 jobs after posting its first sales drop in 13 years. Joining us with more is Jill Schlesinger. She's a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So what's going on with Lego?
Oh, nothing good. So this is a private company. It's headquartered in Denmark. And, you know, it's a company that is iconic, right? Lego. They did say that their first half year sales fell by 5% from a year ago. That's the first drop it's seen in, you ready for this? 13 years.
Wow.
And so they're cutting all these positions, I think, specifically because they're losing business to the other competitors in the space, which is not other traditional toy companies. It's not Mattel or Hasbro that's doing this. This is smartphone apps, many of which are free, and video games. So I don't know. I'm sad about this story.
Yeah, me too. And it actually is kind of amazing that Lego has held on for as long as it has.
True.
Given all the competition. I grew up with Legos, so. I want to ask you about some other stories, because you have been writing about Hurricane Harvey and flood insurance. Most homeowner insurance policies do not cover flood damage, and we know as many as 80% of Harvey victims don't have flood insurance. What happens to those people, and could they be wiped out because of this?
Well, we hope not. What's going to happen is that I think two forms of relief, a safety net, to think about it that way, would be first from charitable organizations. Places like the Red Cross are going to come in and really try to help out. The government is definitely going to have to step in with some sort of relief for those who are affected, or if you have family members. Or, by the way, if this just happens in your town nearby, you go to disasterassistance.gov, and there the government will release details as they are announced. That said, it's really important that if you are affected by a natural disaster, that you really try to take a look at that homeowner's policy before something bad happens, because obviously once something bad happens, who knows where that policy is, and there's so many other details to attend to.
Do people with flood insurance typically get enough to repair the damage?
Well, no. It depends where. But I think the big complaint after Sandy was that the coverage that many of the folks got and from the National Flood Insurance Program was not enough. Now, look, it's something, so I don't want to go crazy here. But, you know, for many of these people, it might have been $30,000, $35,000 that they got, and that wasn't enough. For others, it could have been up to $200,000, $250,000. Sometimes that's not enough, depending where you live. Again, what is likely to happen is the gap is filled by the government. And that is why there are so many analysts now who are saying that this could become a costlier storm than both Katrina as well as Sandy.
We're already hearing, over $100 billion is what the governor of Texas is estimating.
Right. And I would suspect that if you looked at an inflation-adjusted number for Katrina, the inflation in today's dollars, that would be about $160 billion. It would not surprise me if we got to that 160 number.
And you say, by the way, just briefly, if people are eager to make repairs, they should wait until the insurance company has inspected the property.
Oh, absolutely. You can always inform your insurance company, hey, I'm going to do something, a temporary repair, because it's going to help stop the damage. Do that. And also, please talk to your lenders. Let them know you are affected, especially your mortgagers. That's going to be an important part of the process as well.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks.
Take care.
And we've spoken here about health issues following Hurricane Harvey, the toxins in the water flooding Houston's streets. Well, staying with healthcare, how did Houston's hospitals fare? At least 20 of them evacuated patients who then faced floodwaters. Now, nothing approached the horror of Katrina when patients died. You might remember Memorial Medical Center in New Orleans, which lost power and water. A doctor and two nurses were later arrested for hastening the deaths of patients with injections. One of the nurses said she had to help patients through the pain. A jury refused to indict her, and she later helped write laws giving immunity to hospital workers in disasters. So, what did hospitals learn from Katrina, from Superstorm Sandy? Dr. Eric Toner is a senior associate with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's take Ben Taub Hospital in Houston. They decided to evacuate after they lost power. They couldn't because they were surrounded by a moat of water. They ended up calling a local radio station, asking if there was a vendor that could send them food. Citizens Medical Center in Victoria lost air conditioning. Their generators were flooded. We thought that after Katrina and Sandy, that hospitals were doing things like moving generators and food supplies higher. So as you looked at Harvey, what did you see?
I think in general, the hospitals in Harvey did a really good job. Mm. They had spent billions of dollars in hardening their facilities and doing things like moving generators up. But you have to remember that this was the most rain there has ever been.
Right.
You know, considering the amount of flooding, I think that 20-some healthcare facilities evacuating maybe 1,500 patients is a surprisingly low number.
Yeah. Texas Medical Center in Houston, they have 23 hospitals, and they had submarine doors that locked.
Right. Because of their experience with Allison, where their tunnels flooded, and it wiped out many of their laboratories and flooded many of their facilities. So they spent a lot of money putting in these submarine doors, and their tunnels remained dry.
This was Allison in 2001, which the tunnels were where they were going to evacuate patients, and they couldn't.
Right.
Federal health officials can now analyze Medicare claims, and they provided Texas officials likely addresses of people who might be at home and who might have power-dependent ventilators or oxygen concentrators or electric wheelchairs.
Right.
That's new.
That is new, and that's a major advance because the majority of people with medical conditions are not in hospitals. They're at home or they're an outpatient. And we have not invested enough money by any means in preparing our cities and our communities for these patients. And when they lose their source of care, when they lose electricity for their home ventilator, they end up in hospitals that are really needed to take care of the people who are, you know, direct victims of the storm.
What about when to evacuate? Because, you know, there was a lot of criticism that people didn't evacuate sooner, but as Houston's mayor pointed out, to where? You don't know really where the trouble is going to be.
Right.
And for instance, you have someone who's with Citizens Hospitals there in Houston. They did transfer some patients before Harvey made landfall when there was a mandatory evacuation. But the roads were clogged. And so the patients got stuck on the roads. And everybody's thinking back to Rita in 2005.
Right.
The story of the charter bus.
So in 2005 in Houston, a nursing home evacuated. And the bus in which these poor elderly folks were traveling caught fire. And 20-something of them burned to death.
Because of the oxygen tanks in the bus.
Right.
Yeah. And the storm did not hit.
Right. There was
no
storm.
People thought it would.
Yeah. So the decision to evacuate is really tough. You know, it's always better to stay if you can. But if you're going to decide to evacuate, it's best to do it early than try and evacuate in the height of the storm, which is what happened in New York.
Right. And in New York, again, that was because it was the Langone, I believe, a medical center that also had its generators flooded and lost power.
Right.
They've since moved their generators to the roof.
Right.
Is that something, you know, that's recommended?
I think most hospitals at this point have moved the generators. The hard thing in New York and Bellevue and Langone is that they hadn't yet moved all their electrical connecting equipment. So the generators had been moved, but the connections were still in the basement. Mm. And that was part of a major renovation that had been planned for the following year.
What else can hospitals do? Do you know about these special sleds that some of these hospitals have? Talk about that.
So there are a number of vendors have these. They're sort of halfway between a sled and a stretcher. And we use them for bringing people downstairs because it's very hard to carry somebody. So you can put them on the sled, you strap them in, and it's a way to get very large patients or patients with lots of equipment
because
the elevators don't work.
Right, and we remember in Katrina.
Yes, the horrible stories from Memorial.
Very large man who they could not get him out.
And I think probably most hospitals have these sleds now, at least a few of them. Hospitals have been preparing. They're pretty well prepared. Now we have to deal with the rest of the health sector, dialysis centers, methadone clinics, mental health clinics.
Nursing homes.
Nursing homes. There's no federal money. It's hard to convince a CEO that it's good to invest in preparedness. If you have $1 million, is it better to spend it on a parking lot that will allow you to bring in more patients or to spend on preparedness that may never be needed?
Yeah. Well, when we're close to these storms, we think we know the answer.
Right.
And then we drift away. That's Dr. Eric Toner, Senior Associate with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, on how hospitals can handle these disasters. Dr. Toner, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Well, staying with Houston, and in fact, staying with our top story, the rescinding of DACA, because it's making news about Alonzo Guillen resonate even more. He's the 31-year-old so-called dreamer, a well-known radio DJ who got his work permit through DACA. He set out on a boat during Harvey to rescue people. He was swept away and drowned. He's being mourned by the immigrant community in Texas, a third of which is undocumented. And Stella Chavez of KERA met one couple without documentation in Houston. Rebuilding will be more daunting for them.
Nancy Vasquez goes through her little girl's shoes, purple sneakers, pink Minnie Mouse slippers, white sandals. Every one of them is wet. Some are moldy. This is the mess left by Harvey inside the family's rental home in southeast Houston. The night of the flood was terrifying.
Ese día yo no dormí.
I didn't sleep. Around 4 in the morning, I was starting to doze off when I asked him to see what was happening. I could hear the water, and it smelled bad.
Nancy, her husband Johnny, and their 7-year-old daughter Diana prayed. The water was already inside their home. A tree crashed onto the roof, and part of the ceiling cracked open. They knew they had to escape and take their chances walking through chest-deep water. Dad put daughter on his back. He carried their family's white French poodle in one arm and held onto his wife with the other. Nancy was scared. She doesn't know how to swim. Johnny tried to reassure her.
La ansiedad es lo peor, el peor enemigo de uno.
Anxiety and fear is a person's worst enemy. I was trying to tell her that nothing bad was going to happen.
The family eventually reached dry land and waited to be rescued along Interstate 45. Now they spend their days cleaning up the rental home. Their landlord says they have to be out soon. They're staying with a friend from church. They worry about the future.
No tenemos familia.
We don't have family here. We don't have anywhere to go. We have to start over.
Starting over won't be easy. Both parents are undocumented. They say their daughter was born in the U.S., so they should qualify for FEMA help. They've been told by the agency, though, that they can't be approved until Diana's citizenship is verified. They don't know how long that'll be. FEMA confirms that those are the rules, but didn't say how long the process would take. The other problem, neither of them have been able to work. He works for a company that installs carpet and flooring. He drives a company van, which was damaged in the flood, too.
I've told them my hands are tied. They keep calling me to work, but they're not telling me they're going to get me another car.
Nancy, who was born in Mexico City, is a makeup artist and worked out of their home. Johnny, who's Salvadoran, has money saved up, but it's not nearly enough. Tears flow every time Nancy talks about their situation.
There isn't a lot of help for people like us. We've never asked for assistance, and now that we have, there isn't.
So it's back to cleaning out the house and to waiting. For Here and Now, I'm Stella Chavez in Houston.
Yale University is stripping the name of a white supremacist from one of its dorms today. The building, known as a residential college, was named after John C. Calhoun, the former vice president and Yale grad who once called slavery a positive good. In 2016, Yale's administration chose to keep the name, but this year it changed course and announced it would rename the building after another graduate, Grace Murray Hopper, a pioneering computer scientist and World War II Navy admiral. Phoebe Petrovic has the story.
Protests against the name Calhoun College stretch back to when Yale University christened the Gothic dorm in 1933. Over the years, symbols like Confederate battle flags and bullwhips came off the walls, but until now, Calhoun's name remained. When Jonathan Holloway served as the head of Calhoun College, he used to think that seemed right.
I had long held out hope that actually sort of shedding light on who John Calhoun was and shedding light on the fact that Yale made a terrible decision in the 1930s to name a college in his honor, by talking about it, that would be a good thing.
Holloway is a historian and scholar of African American studies and provost of Northwestern University. In 2014, he was Yale's first black dean, and he says his perspective on Calhoun's name changed a year later.
Then Dylann Roof murdered all of those people. And then the idea of hanging on to this name from the stance of sort of historical purity, that started to feel a little bit precious.
The killing of 9 black churchgoers in Charleston, South Carolina, Calhoun's home state, refocused national attention on racism and ignited debates about Confederate flags and memorials. At Yale, administrators discussed renaming Calhoun, but student activists like senior Yvette Estepan were focused on fighting institutional racism.
We were creating quote-unquote demands or whatever. Like, Calhoun almost didn't even make it onto the demand thing. I remember it was like, oh, what are we demanding? And they, like, made this list, and we finally, like, had narrowed it down to 5 or 6. And I remember it barely made it on.
The students wanted material support, like more faculty of color on tenure track. The university rejected only one student demand, renaming Calhoun. At the time, Yale's president, Peter Salove, wrote that changing the name would amount to erasing history. Senior Maya Jenkins saw keeping the name as defending white supremacy.
If you really think that as a black student, as a brown student, as a student of color walking around, that you're going to forget the history of the fact that Yale was built on the backs of your ancestors and on your ancestors' like violently stolen land because of, you know, a symbol, it's clear who you're prioritizing. Like, you're prioritizing the white students who have the privilege to forget.
Jenkins and other student activists, faculty, and many New Haveners refused to take no for an answer, so Salove had a committee make a blueprint for considering requests to change a building's name. The guidelines emphasize history and say that renaming should happen only in exceptional circumstances. John Fabian Witt, a history and law professor who chaired the committee, says in the case of Calhoun,
Yale would never have named a college after John Calhoun in 1850 upon his death. Yale was a place full of critics for John Calhoun in 1850.
Calhoun died before the Civil War. Yale named the college for him in 1933, when whites North and South engaged in a politics of reconciliation that romanticized the war. Mark Perry, senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, says by the time Yale named a college for Calhoun,
that he could be seen as almost a unifying figure who could help diversify the student body there by attracting students from the South.
That's white students from the South. Witt and Perry say that after the Civil War, reconciliation brushed slavery and white supremacy under the rug. And Perry says that's similar timing to Confederate monuments going up decades after the Civil War during Jim Crow. The Chronicle's data team has looked into these monuments, and out of more than 1,500 across the country,
we know of at least 37 Confederate monuments that have been on college campuses since, I think, 2011. 13 of those 37 have been removed since 2012 or are in the process of being removed. And 8 of those 13 are since Charlottesville in particular.
Perry says there are dozens of efforts completed or underway to contextualize or remove racist symbols on campuses like Duke, UT Austin, and Harvard Law. Here at Yale, Calhoun College has been renamed, but John C. Calhoun's name and statues elsewhere on campus will remain. Here's John Witt, the historian who chaired the committee that drew up the blueprint.
I think that the changing of the name to Hopper, combined with the preservation of pieces of Calhoun here, is a way of expressing a kind of dishonor That is, he's still here and he's been dishonored. His legacy has been dishonored. And the university hasn't been engaged in the process of erasing the history of its engagement with Calhoun, either in the 1930s through the Lost Cause mythology or in the 19th century when Yale had any number of connections to slavery. So it's important to preserve that history and also move on, and also move on.
For students like Yvette Estepan and Maya Jenkins, that means moving on to more campaigns for racial justice. And if calls surface to rename more buildings, Yale, for its part, will try to make sense of the material and symbolic meaning of a name, then, now, and for decades to come. For Here and Now, I'm Phoebe Petrovic.
And this program note, Pope Francis arrives in Colombia tomorrow. His visit comes as the South American nation is working through a peace deal that ended a 50-year guerrilla war. That story later on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.